Chapter 10 Vince, in which our hero learns the lesson that there is no lesson at all, there is only life. While we were touring in Japan, Heidi called. It was 5 a.m., so I knew that something had to be wrong. She said that my manager, Bert, was at his home in Nashville and trying desperately to reach me. I called him and he could hardly force the words out. "You're the only one I can talk to," he said. "When I saw you go through this, I never thought that it would happen to me." Bert's son had been playing basketball the previous afternoon with some friends when he suddenly collapsed. A brain aneurysm had killed him on the spot, with no previous symptoms or warnings. After Japan, I flew directly to Nashville to stay with Bert. When Skyler died, he had been right there with me. Now it was my turn, because I knew exactly what he was going through. Tommy, Nikki, and Mick can rag on me about whatever they want, but they don't know. They wouldn't even be able to fathom what it's like to watch as your child dies. If they just put themselves in my shoes for a second, they would hate it. They can never go through that pain. Maybe then they'd understand why I fucking drink so much. My time with Bert was another reminder that life was short and love was rare. When I returned to L.A., I pledged to tie the knot with Heidi. After going out for 7 years, which was longer than I had ever been married, I realized that she was my soulmate. Other women had dated me for the good times, the Ferraris, the Porsches, the mansions, not to mention the incredible sex. But only Heidi had ever stuck around for the bad, through death, depression, and money problems. Heidi knew not to expect a rock and roll fairy tale, an expense account of $20,000 a month for purses, or a husband who had made it through life without the deep scars, guilt, and anger that come with having killed a good friend in a car crash and lost a 4-year-old daughter to cancer. Supposedly, 85% of couples don't even make it through the death of a child, whether they are the natural parents or not. But somehow, Heidi and I made it out the other end, not just as lovers, but also as best friends. We set a wedding date, and then celebrated the decision by going to watch the Kings play hockey. After the game, we ran into Tom Arnold, who introduced us to some of the players. They all wanted to party somewhere, so I suggested the Havana Room, a private cigar club in Beverly Hills, mostly for producers, actors, lawyers, and a plastic surgeon or two. I think I'm the only rocker who's a member. We were all getting sloshed there, except for Tom Arnold, who doesn't drink, when Mel Gibson, who was sitting alone at the bar, asked if he could join us. Eventually, the party wound down to just me, Mel, and Heidi at 3 a.m. The staff wanted to close, but they didn't want to kick us out, so they let us stay there by ourselves and smoke cigars. We left the club an hour later and drove to my house, shot pool, and took goofy Polaroids of each other until 6 in the morning. I passed out, but Mel still wanted a rock. Heidi shook me back to life in the afternoon, laughing. I can't believe I had to kick Mel Gibson out of the house. Sometime after sunrise, she had called him a taxi to take him back to the Four Seasons. That evening, Heidi and I turned on the news, which was broadcasting a story about how the Havana Room had burned down. They said that two gentlemen had stayed at the club late and thrown their lit butts in a trash can, which caught fire and set the place ablaze. Now, on top of everything else, I was an arsonist. Not long afterward, Heidi and I had a small but beautiful Beverly Hills wedding to the tune of Van Morrison's Crazy Love and a coterie of bridesmaids consisting almost entirely of playmates. After everything I had lost, I had a woman who was the most beautiful bride, the most amazing person inside and out that I had ever met. She was the only woman I've dated who could just be one of the guys, from putting money in strippers' G-strings on our first date to smoking stogies with Mel Gibson on our last date as an unmarried couple. I asked one of my closest friends in the whole world to be the best man at the wedding, Nikki Six. Afterward, Heidi and I returned to our house in Beverly Hills and adopted two German shepherds that liked to bite Nikki. I suppose the rest of the band would make fun of me for belonging to a cigar club, living in Beverly Hills, racing cars and trying to be some sort of entertainment mogul. I recently started a production company with Marco Garibaldi, his wife Priscilla Presley, and some stockbrokers from Chicago. We might even hire Doug Thaler to work in the mailroom. But what they don't understand is that I'm doing the same thing I always have. Instead of getting drunk with Tommy and Nikki and their drug dealers, I'm doing the same thing with Mel Gibson. Instead of kicking back and living the good life at the beach, I'm living the good life at the Havana Room. It's important to be true to yourself and not lose your identity by trying too hard to conform to everyone else's expectations and rules. After the insanity of the girls' tour, I think we lost sight of ourselves. Motley Crue became a sober band, then we became a band without a lead singer, then we became an alternative band. But what everybody always loved Motley Crue for was being a fucking decadent band, for being able to walk in a room and inhale all the alcohol, girls, pills, and trouble in sight. I suppose a happy ending would be to say that we learned our lesson and that it's wrong. But fuck that. I like to drink every now and then, and I like to get in trouble. I couldn't be the lead singer of Motley Crue if I didn't. I've been through lawsuits, divorce, addiction, suicide attempts, and more death than I even want to think about. It is time to have fun again. That's why when we hired my old buddy Randy Castillo to take Tommy's place on drums and locked ourselves in the studio to record New Tattoo, it was so easy. There was no brain damage, no waiting 2 weeks to get a guitar tone or snare to sound just right. We went back to basics and finally accepted the fact that we are Motley Crue. We're not a rap band, we're not a pop band. We are nothing but a band that sings about the joys of booze and sex and cars. We are a band that thrives on being unsettled. We thrive on fighting and teaming up three against one. We thrive on me getting fired, Tommy quitting, Nikki overdosing, and Mick being a nutty old man. Everything that should have killed us has only made us more dangerous, powerful, and determined. If I had been on MTV when they asked the band about Chicks, Fire, and Hairspray, I wouldn't have gotten defensive like Nikki. I would have said, you know what? We are about fucking fire, we are about chicks, and we are about hairspray. And that's a whole lot better than being about boredom.